You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Timothy D. Wilson. He's the Cheryl J. Aston, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He received his PhD from the University of Michigan and is internationally known as a researcher in the areas of self-knowledge, happiness, social cognition, and using social psychological principles to solve personal and social problems. At the University of Virginia, he won an All-University Outstanding Teacher Award and the Distinguished Scientist Award. He was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2009. Timothy D. Wilson is the author of Redirect, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change, just published by Little Brown. His earlier book was Strangers to Ourselves, Discovering the Adaptive Unconscious, published by Harvard University Press. The author Malcolm Gladwell said, "There are few academics who write with as much grace and wisdom as Timothy Wilson. I thought his last book, Strangers to Ourselves, was a masterpiece. Redirect is more than its equal." I spoke to Timothy Wilson last week, and when we spoke, I first asked him why the new science of psychological change is a surprise, as the title of his book, Redirect, suggests.
What is surprising is that social psychologists have come up with these relatively simple ways of getting people to change their behavior that don't involve long-term psychotherapy or revisiting people's family histories. They're what I call story editing interventions that get people to just edit the way they think about themselves in ways that have pretty big changes down the road.
Now, the book opens with the story of two policemen in Tampa, Florida, who responded to a house fire. I wondered, how did you decide, as a writer, how did you decide to begin the book with that particular story?
Well, one of the themes of the book is that whatever we try as interventions to help people, we really need to test them scientifically. And just as we would with a medical intervention, if we were introducing a new drug, for example, we'd never do so before thoroughly testing it. Mm-hmm. But we seem to have a different set of criteria for interventions designed to change people's behavior that often they're put into place without a thorough vetting. And the example I opened the book with is about a policeman who witnessed a horrible thing. He tried to rescue a person in a house fire, and the person unfortunately died. And then the policeman discovered that he knew this guy. He was a friend of his. And he was obviously this was extremely traumatic. Mm-hmm. And so his police department did what many policemen departments do, is to suggest that he undergo a procedure called critical incident stress debriefing to talk through his problems to hopefully get them out in the open and avoid post-traumatic stress. This is a technique that's widely used by to first responders. It's used with the lay public. It was used with people after 911 in New York City and so on. And, you know, on the face of it, it makes a lot of sense that talking out something we've witnessed is good, is very cathartic. The only problem is that once this approach was tested, it turns out not only not to work, but there's a little evidence that it actually backfires. It makes people remember these events more. It solidifies these horrible memories in their minds. So it's a beautiful example of the way to start the book, saying, look, let's be careful what we introduce.
Right, and it was an incredibly effective example because the idea of witnessing something so horrible, and I'm sure that would just put an image in his mind for all time, really,
right.
Particularly if he talked about it. Well, you know, I think before we talk any more, Tim, perhaps the best thing would be if you would read a little bit from the book so that we get an idea of what story editing is, which I know is a big part of Redirect.
Sure. I'm reading from my first chapter. The new approach of story editing began with the theorizing of Kurt Willen, who helped found the field of social psychology in the 1930s and 1940s. Lewin championed the subjectivist view, namely that in order to understand why people do what they do, we have to view the world through their eyes and understand how they make sense of things. But he had a more radical insight. Not only do we need to view a problem through other people's eyes, we can also change the way they view it with relatively simple interventions. True, people's self-views are often embedded in years of family dynamics, personal relationships, and cultural forces, and we can't always expect people to revise these views overnight. If a teenager is a rebel without a cause, it doesn't do much good for his parents to implore, "Please change your view of yourself," any more than it would be to say, "I would appreciate it if you would lay off the crystal meth and lose the lip piercing and take flute lessons." Narratives are often like an oil painting to which we add a little dab each day. Revising that narrative would mean scraping away layers of paint and starting over again with a fresh canvas, a daunting task to say the least. But as Lewin noted, sometimes it is possible to change people's interpretations fairly easily if we find just the right approach. During World War II, Lewin demonstrated this by getting people to change what seemed like an intractable food preference, namely an aversion to organ meats like kidneys and hearts, which were in greater supply at the time than traditional cuts of meat. Simply lecturing people about the importance of this alternative food source didn't work. Instead, Lewin convened groups of homemakers to discuss the issue. During the meetings, a trained leader skillfully steered the conversation to the ways in which obstacles to serving organ meats could be overcome, such as how to deal with complaints from one's family. Women who took part in these groups were much more likely to serve organ meats in the following week than were those who simply listened to the lecture. Since then, new generations of social psychologists have refined Lewin's idea into an approach that I call story editing, which is a set of techniques designed to redirect people's narratives about themselves and the social world in a way that leads to lasting changes in behavior. Now, let me just jump ahead a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
To summarize, the story editing approach tries to change people's personal interpretations of themselves and the social world in ways that make them happier and lead to more desirable behaviors. It is a family of approaches developed by social psychologists that includes writing exercises, the story prompting approach in which people are directed toward new ways of explaining and understanding their behavior to replace self-defeating thinking patterns, and the do good, be good strategy in which people are encouraged to create new interpretations by first changing their behavior. The key to each approach is that people end up with a more desirable way of viewing themselves that builds on and reinforces itself, leading to sustained change. Now, to be sure, this approach is not the cure for all societal problems. No one would argue that the cure for homelessness is to get homeless people to interpret their problem differently. Sometimes big structural changes are needed to attack deep-seated problems. But story editing can help solve many vexing problems, even some seemingly deep-seated ones.
Thank you for reading that. It's very interesting. I'm wondering, so for an example, can you talk a little bit about how that policeman might have approached story editing in order to have a better outcome than the critical incident stress debriefing that he went through?
Sure. Well, there is another approach I talk about, and that is some writing exercises that social psychologists have developed, in particular a social psychologist named James Pennebaker. And the idea here is to let things settle for a while. Don't try to revisit the traumatic event right away.
Mm-hmm.
Often the best approach is distraction, just going home and playing with our kids or watching TV and trying to put the event out of our minds. And then wait and see what happens. If we're still having trouble getting over it, we keep find ourselves thinking about it. After a few weeks go by, there's this simple writing exercise where people are instructed to just take out a piece of paper and write about the event that's troubling them for about 10 or 15 minutes before they go to bed, doing it maybe three or four nights in a row. And this is not easy, I should add, to actually have to put our word down on paper about what's troubling us is can be upsetting. But it forces us to reorganize it and think about it in a different way, to perhaps to edit our stories, if you will. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of good research showing that people who do this have remarkable recoveries, that they're healthier after a few months, they attend work more, if they're students they get better grades. It's just a way, again, to force us to find meaning in an event in a way that we couldn't do so before.
Okay, great. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the specific importance of the act of writing as a useful approach, as opposed to speaking out loud to somebody. I know that part of what's different is waiting and setting aside the feeling of, you know, an immediate need to talk about it. But I'm curious, like, what is the act of writing, what does that do to help us?
Well, good question. And I should add that Pennebaker's research shows that it doesn't actually have to be writing, that speaking aloud to ourselves into a tape recorder, for example, can work as well.
Okay.
But what these have in common, I think, I think the natural tendency for many of us, if something is troubling us, is to try not to think about it. It's, you know, why would I want to dwell on something that's upsetting me? And yet that prevents us from analyzing in a way that might enable us to find some meaning and get beyond it. Mm-hmm. So these writing exercises or talking aloud exercises force us to confront the event, think about it, restructure it. In fact, the people in Pennebaker's studies who recover the best are those who start out with a very jumbled, kind of disjointed way of looking at the event. But after the writing exercise, they're telling themselves a much more coherent story about it, mm-hmm. something that makes sense to them and allows them to put it behind them.
Okay. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about something you already mentioned when you did when you read your excerpt, and that's the do good, be good approach to managing problems.
Yes, this is one of my favorite areas of research in social psychology, and it's the idea that if you want to change or get someone else to change, often the best way to do it is to change our behavior first, and then our attitudes and feelings will follow from that. And it's kind of counterintuitive. We tend to think that, well, people do what they do because of how they feel and what they think. Well, that's true, but the reverse is also true, that we're good observers of our own behavior and draw inferences from what we do. So this technique has been used. One of my favorite examples here is a program that's been developed to help adolescents avoid teenage pregnancies. It's a program that's used in schools in which teens are asked to do community service for a year. They get to pick a local agency, such as a daycare center or old people's home, and they're asked to commit to a certain number of hours where they go and do volunteer work. Mm-hmm. Now, you might ask, what does doing volunteer work have to do with adolescent pregnancies? Well, I think what happens is that the kids that are most apt to get into trouble are those who feel kind of alienated and disconnected from their communities. And getting involved in something like volunteering at a daycare center changes their view of themselves, where they begin to feel more connected and less alienated. And indeed, the kids who take part in this program compared to control groups of kids, the girls are less likely to get pregnant. Both boys and girls do better in school as a result of this behavior change.
Okay. Another thing you talk about in the book is the difference between the story editing approach and the power of positive thinking movement, which was very popular for a time, or maybe still is, I don't know. But can you talk about the difference between these things?
Yeah, I'm a little hard on books like The Secret, and I do. It's kind of hard to talk about because on the one hand, I think there is something to the message about positive thinking, but I start to worry when books like The Secret do so in a very non-scientific way and imply that all we have to do is kind of sit on the couch and think good things and then magically we'll find the love of our life and become rich and so on.
Right. Now, I'm just going to interrupt you. For people who don't know the book, The Secret, what is that? Go ahead and just mention what
that
is.
Sure. Now, this was a best-selling DVD and book in which the basic thesis was there's this power of the universe called the power of attraction, and that if we can harness it by thinking positive thoughts, then we can pretty much get anything we want. Mm-hmm. And once something negative enters our mind, that ruins this power of attraction. And so if I want to, say, get money or lose weight or do better at my job, if I just imagine that happening and think positive thoughts, it's more likely to happen, is mm-hmm. the basic thesis.
Okay.
And, you know, why that worries me is there are stories of people who buy into this and avoid medical treatments that can help them because they think all they have to do is think positive thoughts. And, you know, if people take it that far so that they are not doing things that really would help them,
right,
that's a problem. But on the other hand, there is some good research that shows that certain kinds of positive thinking are helpful. And it's not the kind where we just sit on the couch and imagine being rich. It's imagining how we're going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
That if we actually take some time to think about, I'd like to accomplish X, Y, and Z, I'm going to imagine myself having those things, but also what it's going to take to get there. That sort of optimism, yes, I can do it, is helpful. Particularly, I mean, what really separates positive thinkers or optimists from pessimists is how they deal with obstacles in their path or adversity. You know, we all run into obstacles on our way to trying to get something. The pessimist is likely to give up and say, okay, I guess I can't do it, where the optimist is more likely to say, okay, I didn't get it that way. What else can I do to reach my goal?
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of positive thinking, I'm a fan of.
Okay. All right, great. This is a related question, I think. Can you talk a little bit about the self-help industry?
Well, I mean, I would put The Secret in that category. And, you know, it all depends what people want to get out of a self-help book or video. I mean, it's a huge industry. You go to the bookstore, there's, you know, shelves and shelves of books that promise to make you happier or a better parent or a more effective person at work and so on and so forth. And, you know, I guess, you know, my main beef is a lot of these books aren't based on science. There's a lot of good research out there that shows how to do those things, but these books are just kind of the author's sense of how to do it, and sometimes it's really, you know, if it gets to the point of the hocus pocus law of attraction stuff, then that's kind of worrisome.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it's as I say, if people read these books with the attitude, well, you know, it could be a fun read and maybe it'll be entertaining, that's one thing. But if they really think that these books are going to change their lives, when they're not based on good research, that's a little worrisome.
I thought it was really interesting in Redirect where you mentioned, I'm actually not looking at the page right now, I'm trying to remember, but I think that you said that the audience that reads self-help books tends to be the same audience and they come back every 8 months to buy the next self-help book. Is that right? Is it 8 months?
Yes, there is some 18 months actually, yes.
Oh, 18.
There is, you know, the reader who... that's the person who's most likely to buy a self-help book is someone who bought one a year and a half ago or so. And, you know, I it's funny. One great thing about writing a book is you get kind of random emails from readers with various questions and things, which I love getting. And I got one from one fellow who took me to task for that a little bit. He says, look, just because I buy a book again doesn't mean that this whole industry is bogus. It just means I'm an open-minded person who's open to new approaches. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, fair enough. On the other hand, if these books really worked, if there was one that could really turn us all into happy, wealthy people, then why would we need to buy another one?
Right, right. Okay. I found it really interesting and also distressing as a parent to read in your book that programs like DARE, where the police come into the schools to talk to students about things like drug use and peer pressure, aren't found to have worked. They've been used by schools for decades, and billions of dollars have gone into funding these programs, and they do not work. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, you know, I do have sort of pet peeves about this. My wife was on the school board in Charlottesville for 6 years and just got elected to city council, actually. So we talk about this a lot, the kinds of programs that a community buys into. And, you know, I think the problem is a lot of these programs really seem to make sense. Mm-hmm. That why wouldn't it help for kids to hear police officers talk about the dangers of drugs and so on? And, well, you know, common sense isn't always right, and if any message gets through in this book, I hope it's that we can't take it for granted, and we really need to put these things to the test. And people have done that with the DARE program, and unfortunately, there's no evidence in, you know, really good, well-controlled studies that it reduces drug use or alcohol use or smoking in kids. In fact, there's even one study that shows that it increased some of those things. Now, since then, the DARE program has been revamped, but why wouldn't we test these things in the same way we test medical interventions is kind of my beef.
Yeah, yeah. Did the police feel very strongly, do you know, about it? Do they seem to support it still, or do you think that they feel that it doesn't work? Do you know?
Well, I haven't talked to any police involved, but so I'm only speculating, But, you know, I can imagine if I were a police officer, the ones who do it go through a training program to do it. And I would think I'd feel pretty good about it. I really would feel like I'm helping and a chance to go into schools and meet kids. It may actually establish more trust with police departments. That I don't think it's been looked at. The research focuses on the actual substance abuse in kids.
Sure. Sure.
I think I would feel pretty good about it, but again, we just can't take for granted that it's the best approach.
Yeah, right. The book uses the results of a lot of different tests and experiments to make its points, or to support hypotheses. And yet, it's very readable, the book. And I'm wondering.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, sure. For writers of nonfiction, I'm wondering if you can speak to using data in a book that's intended for a wider audience than just the scientific community, and not letting that data make the subject matter become dry.
Well, sure. I think there's a great thing happening in the book world, and that is more and more books on psychology, and in particular social psychology, my discipline, that really do talk about the science in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. Some of these books are written by journalists, such as Malcolm Gladwell, who's obviously really, really good at it, and talking about the research in interesting ways.
Right.
And sometimes the scientists themselves, such as myself, take a shot at it. And, it's funny, Malcolm Gladwell came to a convention of psychologists a year or so ago and gave a talk to us and talked about this very issue you raise of, how can you write for the general public?
Right.
And his main message was, you folks get a little lost in the numbers sometimes. Tell good stories.
Yeah.
And, that's the approach I've tried to take in this book is yes, it's all based on research, but, don't lose sight of the fact that there's a lot of really interesting human interest stories that the research connects to, and talk about the research through those stories.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that gets us back to where we started, which is how you opened the book with the story about the policeman in Florida, which is a tragic story, but it immediately personalizes the points that you're making, and then leads naturally into sort of the science of how we can help.
There are... I do think there's a lot of good stories in here, and there's ones that stay with me. I mean, one that comes to mind is in a chapter on adolescent violence. There's a story about a man in Oakland, California, who worked with a lot of at-risk youth. He coached football teams, and he was just really tired. He put it, he was just really tired of going to funerals. These kids would often get involved in gangs, and many of them were dying at a young age. And he just racked his brains, you know, what can I do to connect with these kids? And he decided the best approach was to try to scare them, basically, into going straight. So he actually got a second job at a funeral home so that he would have access to it, and he would gather groups of these kids together and take them there and show them what would happen if they were to die, how they'd be put on a gurney, and exactly what the process is of dealing with dead bodies. And he was convinced that, you know, he was really going to get through to these kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the one hand, I so admire his dedication, but what's very sad about it is there's good research showing that that approach not only doesn't work, but actually backfires, that these scared straight programs, for whatever reason, really good studies show they actually make kids more likely to commit crimes.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we need is some way to connect the dedication of folks like this fellow with the research. And that's, if I can do that in some small way in this book, I'll be very happy.
Yeah. This is a quote from Redirect. "We are strangers to ourselves, the owners of highly sophisticated unconscious minds that hum along parallel to our conscious minds, interpreting the world and constructing narratives about our place in it. It is these unconscious narratives that social psychologists target." I thought that was a really beautiful bit of writing and also really interesting. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the unconscious and this explanation of it.
Well, you've given me an opening to plug my previous book, which is, in fact, called Strangers to Ourselves.
Oh, okay.
I
knew that, but I didn't put it together with this quote.
That talks about that very topic of psychology's kind of modern view of the unconscious. Well, I think it's one thing that makes these stories hard to study is I don't think they're entirely conscious. I mean, obviously we have some sense of how we view the world and how we think about ourselves, but often these are implicit assumptions that don't bubble up into consciousness completely. And that's a challenge to the scientists trying to study them. And often it's like a black box that we have to kind of probe and try to change and see what comes out the other end.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think these kinds of implicit stories are really crucial to understanding what people do.
Yeah. I think this is related. There was another quote in the book. This was actually a quote from Kurt Vonnegut in his book, Mother Night. "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be." I thought that was great.
I mean, that's back to the so-called do-good, be-good approach that I think it's our behavior that we are always watching ourselves and drawing inferences about who we are based on what we do, and hence we should be careful what we do, and if we're going to pretend to be something, be careful because we may assume that's who we are.
Right, yeah. Am I correct in thinking that perhaps we're sort of fooling our unconscious when we are pretending to be something?
That's a reasonable way to put it, I think. Now, of course, that can be in a good way, and there are there are a lot of 12-step programs and others that use this approach that say, you know, just take a little step at a time, try to avoid a temptation once, and that will register within your unconscious as something you succeeded at. So, I think that's true.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting, the story about the Huntington's gene and the sort of negative effects of uncertainty regarding this disease.
Yeah, that's a really interesting study. I mean, there's a chapter in the book on our personal narratives and our own happiness and what the relationship is. And the point is how important it is to find meaning in our lives and to be able to understand particularly negative things that are happening to us. And this was a study that looked at young people who were at risk of getting Huntington's disease because one of their parents had died of it. And if that's the case, we would have a 50% chance of having inherited that gene and getting the disease ourselves. But it's a terrible disease because it has no symptoms until adulthood, and so people live with a lot of uncertainty as to whether they have gotten it or not. This is the disease that Woody Guthrie died of, and his son Arlo Guthrie lived for years before knowing that he, in fact, did not have the gene. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out there is now a genetic test people can take to find out. And so the question is, should we take it? I mean, if we are, say, 18 or 19 or 20, and we want to know whether we're going to die of this disease because there's no cure for it, should we take the test? And when I ask people that, there's a real sort of split opinion. And a lot of people say, well, no, I think, it would be so terrible to find out that risk this possibility of knowing that I have this awful thing. Well, there was a study done in which they gave the genetic test to a sample of people, and some of them got the good news that they didn't have the gene. Some got the bad news that they did. But there was a third group that either chose not to take the test, or in a small number of cases, the test is inconclusive, so it can't tell you whether you have it or not. And the question is, which of those three groups did best psychologically? Those that knew they had the disease, those that knew they were healthy, or the uncertain group? They tracked these folks for about a year and gave them all sorts of psychological batteries. And, you would think, or at least I would assume, that the group that's going to do the best are those who got the good news.
Right.
And they were very happy at first. But after a year, interestingly, they were indistinguishable from the group that got the bad news. That those who got the bad news were devastated at first, but they succeeded in somehow coming to terms with this, finding meaning in it, telling themselves some sort of story that maybe their life would be short, but they would make the most of it or whatever. So that, again, after a year, they were as psychologically healthy as the group with the good news. The group that really was the worst off psychologically was the uncertain group that didn't know whether they had it. And, one way I like to put this is the group that was 100% certain that they were going to die at a young age was happier than the group that was only 50% certain.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's all about meaning making, that if you don't know what to make meaning of, you don't know whether you have the gene or not, you're in this terrible state of uncertainty where you probably think about it a lot, you don't know what to make of it or what kind of story to tell yourself. So sometimes bad news is, if you're going to get it early so we can make sense of it.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of when a loved one is sick. I think it's almost harder to worry about them than it is to grieve them later. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, it's a poignant example for me because my mother passed away this past summer after 3 years of cancer, and it was, there's a lot of uncertainty with the disease, and even if ultimately it's probably going to be fatal, there's lots of valleys and along the way and mountains that you got to climb of treatments and so on, and not knowing exactly what the outcome is, that's not a good state to be in.
Yeah. At least knowing that you had, for example, the Huntington's gene, you could sort of let go of all of the worry,
right,
or all of the worst case scenarios and live your life with the knowledge.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I keep quoting other authors, but you included them in the book, so it's your fault. I love Ian McEwan. I love his novels, and you quote a line from his book, Enduring Love, which is an amazing book. People often remark on how quickly the extraordinary becomes commonplace. We are highly adaptive creatures. The predictable becomes, by definition, background, leaving the attention uncluttered, the better to deal with the random or unexpected. Which maybe is relevant to what we were just talking about, but I also think it's very relevant for writers who sometimes wait years to get published only to find that this particular goal, isn't the end of the line, and that once you do, in fact, get published, there's still a writing life after that. There's another goal to set. And you had a good story about that. I wonder if you can maybe talk about that a little bit.
Well, sure. I mean, I'm an Ian McEwan fan, too. In fact, I've often wondered if he has any training in psychology, because he has uncanny, maybe he's just a very smart guy, I don't know. But anyway, it is amazing how much our minds are able to make sense and find meaning in things. And in the Huntington's gene case, that is a really good thing when something terrible is confronting us. But there is this odd other side of the coin of the good things in life. I mean, should we seek to understand them and keep a little bit of uncertainty involved there? And, you know, I've done a fair amount of research on that topic, and it turns out that if we're confronted by something really good, that not resolving it keeps it fresh and in our minds and working towards it.
Mm-hmm.
So the example you give of publishing, I mean, I do give an example of the book of me when I first started in this field and getting that letter in the mail that my first psychology article had been accepted for publication was just thrilling. I mean, I'd been working towards this, and I was so happy. If you had asked me in advance, I would have said, you know, I'll be on cloud nine for well, I don't know, weeks maybe at least.
Right.
But, you know, once these things happen, you know, we begin to kind of, as McEwen says, they become the background. Say, yeah, okay, I could sort of see that coming. You know, it was nice, but wasn't all that amazing. The more we kind of understand it and make sense of it, how could it have turned out any differently? And we set our sights on the next thing and
right.
kind of put that one behind us.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. You know, just thinking about that book, I will say, you were saying you wonder if he's got any sort of scientific background. One thing that I loved about that book was he footnotes certain things about this disease that this person in the book has, and he the footnotes link to scientific articles written by someone. And if you look at the back of the book and actually look at all the footnotes, the person he's quoting, it's an anagram for Ian McEwen. It's really
funny. I don't know if I knew that. I read the book, but I think I forgot that or didn't know it. That's interesting.
Funny. Okay, so back to your book. A large focus of Redirect is the well-being of children, how to be better parents to our children, and also how to help our children avoid teenage pregnancy, violence, alcohol, and drug use. And there's one part where you talk about using labels to help kids interpret success or failure.
Yeah, I think, you know, our job as parents, one might say, is to help our kids develop healthy narratives about themselves and the world. And, you know, I think that's we'd all agree to that. But the question is how to do it and how to help them in that process. And, you know, when kids are young, it can help just to kind of label their behavior for them, that they often don't know exactly what it means to act in a certain way or what conclusions they should draw from it. There's a famous study done in school where they wanted to get the kids to litter less, and what worked remarkably well was just for the teacher to label the kids as those who cared about the environment and didn't litter, and just sort of saying, oh, really? I guess that's who I am. They internalized that and didn't throw their trash on the floor. And, you know, when kids get a little older, I think it gets a little trickier. And there the question becomes, you know, how controlling are we going to be as parents? That,
uh-huh.
You know, we have to use punishments and rewards to some extent. I mean, that's how we get kids to eat their peas and not do dangerous things. But if we're too heavy-handed at it, then the kids, you know, their story is, oh, I'm doing this to please mom or dad or to avoid the wrath of mom and dad. And they're not internalizing that these are things I believe in or I care about. And so the trick is to use punishments and rewards, you know, lightly, just enough to get the kids to do what we want, but not so strongly that they conclude that's why they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Which admittedly is a delicate balance, but...
Yeah, and it reminds me of when my children were little and you know, there was a lot in the books about don't say that your child is a bad child, you're being a bad boy, you know.
Well, I mean, that is true, and, you know, the other side of that coin is true as well, is research by the psychologist Carol Dweck shows beautifully that we shouldn't say to our kids, you're a really smart kid, for example, that the problem there is that we don't want our kids to develop a theory about their abilities that it's something they have or not. It's this entity that you're born with. Because then, if they stumble along the way, they get a bad grade on a test, the logical conclusion is, oh, I guess I don't have this thing called smartness.
Mm-hmm.
Dweck suggests that instead we encourage the view in our kids that intelligence is something it's like a muscle that we strengthen through practice. And that we can learn and work towards, And so when our kids come home and get an A on the spelling test, I know I certainly was sorely tempted to say to them, like, it's, wow, you're so smart. But better, Dweck says, to say, wow, you should be proud of yourself. You worked really hard in studying for that test.
That
conveys a much better message.
Well, Tim, I'm curious, you already mentioned that you had written a previous book, Strangers to Ourselves, and now Redirect is out. What are you working on now?
You know, there were 9 years between these two books, so I don't have another one exactly right in the pipeline. But I'm still an active researcher. I do research on happiness and how well people can predict it, what we call affective forecasting. And we find that often people aren't entirely accurate in predicting how happy things will make them in the future. We tend to think that all our problems will be solved if something happens, like we win the lottery, and that the world will end as we know it if something terrible happens. And although those things do make us feel very good or very bad, we're much more resilient than we give ourselves credit for, I think, often. It's back to the McEwen quote, that when things happen, they become the background, and we adapt and move on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm working on mostly at the moment.
Okay. And how about, what do you like to read? Mostly in your field, or do you like to read fiction? Do you like to read all sorts of things?
Yeah, I do read all sorts of things.
You read Ian McEwan and Kurt Vonnegut, so.
I was just lamenting that I feel like I have less time for fiction than I used to, but I always love fiction. I read every short story in The New Yorker that comes out, for example. I would just say it's eclectic. My son is a journalist and an avid, he was an English major, and he's one of my chief sources. He feeds me books. One that he gave me recently was Tom McCarthy's The Remainder, which is a British novel that's really amazing and disturbing and interesting all at once. I read all sorts of stuff.
So my last question for you, Tim, is can you offer advice for other writers who are working on books in the field of psychology, books that they are hoping to see as problem-solving or helpful, useful to readers, but real help and not just trendy self-help?
Sure. I think what I say will be pretty obvious. First, make it science-based. One reaction I got to my book is, wait a minute, isn't your book a self-help book too? And, I don't really view it that way. I hope it has some good advice for people, but it is all based on current research. So it's grounded in the science, and that's obviously important. But the other, I guess I just repeat Malcolm Gladwell's advice of make it fun to read. Tell stories. Don't get too bogged down in the details of, when we write journal articles, there hardly could be a more boring medium. You're just forced to give all the facts and details, and we randomly assign 17 people to this condition, and so one needs to, if you're in the field, get beyond that, and if you're not, just make it fun and interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Great advice. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today about your book Redirect, which is published by Little Brown, and it was a pleasure.
Moshe, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Timothy D. Wilson. You can read more about Dr. Wilson and Redirect at his book's Facebook page, which is called Redirect Timothy D. Wilson. So if you search for that on Facebook, you should find him. Today's Write the Book prompt was offered by my guest, Timothy D. Wilson. He suggests that when we are in public, writers might listen to people talking on their cell phones. People will say the most bizarre, intimate things in front of others very often when they're on their phones. Take something that you overhear and just imagine what the larger story is, and then use that as a prompt to tell either that person's story or some other story that you make up. Dr. Wilson and his daughter actually collect sentences that they overhear in this way. He says it's a one-sided conversation when you hear somebody on their cell phone, and so the context can be hard to discern, which makes it even more fun. Another possibility for a prompt this week is to try the Pennebaker writing exercises that Timothy Wilson explains in his book. Full directions about trying the exercises can be found at James W. Pennebaker's website at the University of Texas in Austin. If you go to the university's website and search the name Pennebaker, then you'll find his page. The school's website is http://homepage.psy.utexas.edu. A copy of Timothy Wilson's prompt, as well as the full website link to James Pennebaker's exercises, will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with the exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And you can also send emails to that address with suggestions for writing prompts, and if I choose to use one, I will credit you for it. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about volunteering at The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.